The title of today's talk is Bury the Proud in the Dust. What we're going to do is look particularly at the second speech of God. Where we left it in the last talk was that we've had the whole of the debate between Job and his three friends. We've then had the response of Elihu coming in, bringing a different perspective, introducing God, and then we had the majesty of God's first speech. And if you read the commentators, they're without exception, they talk about the beauty of this first speech of God, how marvelous it is as he covers the powers in earth, the powers in the heavens, as he covers God's control of the animals and the guidance and the development of the animals, and of course the response of Job to be in awe of the Almighty that is presented before him. But then the commentators, you find, start to get a little confused as they move to the second speech of God. And some of the commentators are actually quite dismissive. They say things like, the second speech seems to be rather repetitive, as if it's of the line of, oh, and here are two more animals. Let me show you Behemoth and about him, and let me show you Leviathan about him. And it doesn't seem to have the same thread of consistency, the same power as the first. Well, I'd like to suggest to you that those commentators have missed the point completely of this second speech. This second speech of God is the absolute pinnacle of the book. This is what the book is about. The whole of the book is working up to this second speech. But we have to understand what this speech is about to appreciate that. Fundamentally, this second speech of God, in comparison with the first, this second one is about redemption and judgment. The first one is about God's power over the natural creation. This second one is about God's power over the spiritual creation. In the first one, we see him guiding the literal animals. We see him guiding the literal earth and the heavens. And we see him a God of nature, as it were. And in this one, we see him a God of spirit, a God of justice. And I'd like to try and demonstrate this to you in no uncertain terms. First of all, when Job responds to God and says, I have nothing to say, and I can't answer you, God says in verse 6 of chapter 40 that I'm not over yet. I haven't finished. Brace yourself like a man, is actually verse 7. I will question you and you shall answer me. I've got some more things to say to you, Job. We're not finished yet. We've covered the natural creation. That's fine, but I'm not finished yet. And look, therefore, at how he really starts this second speech. Verse 8. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? And this is actually a major theme throughout Scripture. When we're at the situation that we almost sometimes rail against God. We ask God, why are you doing it this way? It's not fair, it's not fair. Come to the New Testament and you'll see Paul addressing this issue in Romans chapter 3. He's been talking about the way the Jewish people have departed from the true faith of God, and he then brings the other side of it. What advantage then is there in being a Jew, or what value in circumcision? Much in every way. First of all, they've been entrusted with the very words of God. And then he says, well, but some of them didn't have faith. What should we conclude about them? Will their lack of faith nullify God's faithfulness? And the answer is in verse 4 of Romans 3. Not at all. Let God be true and every man a liar. That is, if we have a choice either of assuming God is true or human beings are true, then we take the first choice. God is true, even if it means that every human being is found out to have falsehood in them, is found out to be a liar. That's what Paul is saying. Let God be true and every man a liar. As it is written, so that you may be proved right when you speak and prevail when you judge. And if you just take that little quotation there from the Psalms out of context, it's not entirely clear why Paul is quoting this. So let's actually look at it in context. And it's Psalm 51. The psalm that we were looking at last night, Psalm 51, the psalm when David is struggling with his sin over Bathsheba and Uriah, and he's coming to God, And he says, Psalm 51, verse 3, "For I know my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are proved right when you speak and justified when you judge." God had sent Nathan to him and said, "You are the man. You are the one that has done this sinful thing." And David now has a choice. Does he stand up and say, "No, I am right and God is wrong"? Or does he say, "I am a sinner. I acknowledge my sin. I have done wrong. And I acknowledge my sin in order to emphasize that God is right. Against you," verse 4, "you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are proved right when you speak and justified when you judge." And so David acknowledges that the righteousness of God demands that we acknowledge our own sinfulness. Paul recognizes that the righteousness of God makes us recognize that there are times when we don't speak the truth. Let every man be a liar. Let God be true and every man a liar. And this is the same issue that God is confronting Job with in verse 8 of chapter 40. "Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself?" Job, you're in this situation where you're saying, "I don't deserve this. God should not have brought this upon me." And God is saying, "Do you realize what you're saying, Job? You're saying that your righteousness and the fact that you don't really deserve this and that I was wrong to bring it upon you, that claim is making me out to be unjust." Is your own self-image important enough that you're willing to condemn me? And God goes on in this part from verse 9 onwards to say, let us think about the whole issue of justice and judgment. And let's pick it up particularly at verse 12. "Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them in the dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. Then I myself will admit to you that your own right hand can save you." And we've talked about these verses earlier in the week. God is saying to Job, "Look, Job, if you have the power to bring righteous judgment, of bringing the proud down, of bringing the wicked down, of being able to say, yes, this one is wicked and this one is righteous, and being able to act on that, that very ability of discernment is something that also has the ability of salvation. But of course, the implication is you cannot do that. You, Job, are not powerful enough to bring the proud man down, to bring the wicked and bury them in the dust together. And likewise, you're not powerful enough to bring your own salvation." So do you see the point that I'm trying to make from verse 8 through verse 14? The whole theme that God is developing here is one of judgment, justice, righteousness, wickedness, the balance between them, Job's ability to bring justice versus God's ability to bring justice. This whole speech is started off, the first part of it has started off all about spiritual judgment. And then he introduces two more animals. Well, there's obviously something of a disconnect there. I think we have to conclude that when he introduces Behemoth, when he introduces Leviathan, he's carrying on the same message. He's trying to make the same point. He's developing the theme, but now in a pictorial way. And I'm going to suggest to you that God is describing rebellion and pride in mankind. He's not talking about animals. In this speech, he doesn't care about animals. He's talked about animals in the previous speech, and he did it extensively. Now, he's talking about rebellion. He's talking about pride. And he's introducing symbols that form the basis of prophetic symbolism throughout the rest of Scripture. Remember, Job is one of the earliest books. The events written around the time of the coming out of Israel, coming out of Egypt. Here we find some of the earliest uses of these symbols that get picked up throughout Scripture and that find their culmination even in something like the book of Revelation. Let me give you an analogy. Think, if you will, of Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel 7, Daniel has an image of beasts, four different beasts that he sees one after the other. Now, when we read those chapters, we don't say, I wonder what that fourth beast was. Is it a lion, or is it a this, or is it a that? We see it simply as a prophetic creature. We see it as something which is intended to be descriptive. We don't believe that there's actually an animal in the animal kingdom that has iron teeth. Just doesn't exist. But there in the vision, in the symbol, is something that's tremendously powerful. And so when somebody says to you, yes, I think that the behemoth is the hippopotamus and the leviathan is the crocodile or something like that, that's missing the point completely. Just as it would be if we tried to say, oh, that fourth beast in Daniel 7 is a such and such. These creatures that we have here, the creatures that we have in Daniel 7, elsewhere, they are modeled on real creatures, but it's not the animals itself. Themselves that God are describing, I'd like us to see some similar passages before we start to explore Behemoth, Leviathan in great detail. Come with me to Isaiah 27. Isaiah 27 and verse 1. In that day, the Lord will punish with his sword his fierce, great, and powerful sword, Leviathan, the gliding serpent, Leviathan, the coiling serpent. He will slay the monster of the sea. What's being talked about here? Well, this whole section of Isaiah, starting in approximately chapter 24 and going through to the end of chapter 27, is all about the judgment of the Lord. It's a resurrection section of Isaiah. It's tremendously powerful, just in its own right. Look at 25 verse 7, Isaiah 25 verse 7. Well, we're going to verse 6 for context. On this mountain, he's talking about Zion, on this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. It's almost Revelation 21, isn't it? And here it is, on this mountain, destroying the shroud, swallowing up death forever. It's resurrection that's being talked about. Chapter 26 and verse 19. But your dead will live, their bodies will rise. You who dwell in the dust, wake up and shout for joy. Your dew is like the dew of the morning. The earth will give birth to her dead. And so we've got resurrection just bursting out of these passages here. And it's not just resurrection, because resurrection is fundamentally associated with judgment. And so in chapter 24 and verse 21, we read, in that day the Lord will punish the powers in the heavens above and the kings on the earth below. Again, it's almost an epitome of Revelation. In that day the Lord will punish the powers in the heavens above and the kings on the earth below. Or chapter 25 and verse 10. The hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain, but Moab will be trampled under him as straw is trampled down in the manure. And so you've got resurrection and you've got judgment coming directly throughout these two chapters. And moreover, we have very powerful Genesis language pervading these chapters. Look at chapter 26 and verse 17. As a woman with child and about to give birth writhes and cries out in her pain, so were we in your presence, O Lord. And the idea of the seed of the woman and through travail that she would bring forth a child. And it carries on, verse 18. We were with child. We writhed in pain, but we gave birth to wind. the agonies that we went through, O Lord, we recognize never produced the seed. We have not brought salvation to the earth. We have not given birth to people of the world. We failed to bring seed. Instead, God will bring his seed, and he will bring his seed out of the dust. Your dead will live, their bodies will rise. It's like Abel's blood crying out from the ground. Verse 21, see, the Lord is coming out of his dwelling to punish the people of the earth for their sins. The earth will disclose the blood shed upon her. She will conceal her slain no longer. And so you see that the Genesis language is starting to pervade this time of judgment, this time of resurrection, and that Genesis language is fulfilled in chapter 27 and verse 1 that we've already read. In that day, the Lord will punish with his sword, his fierce, great, and powerful sword, Leviathan, the gliding serpent, Leviathan, the coiling serpent. He will slay the monster of the sea, and the serpent will finally be crushed. Let's go back to Psalm 68 and verse 28. Again, a psalm which has many echoes of the apocalypse. The whole context of this psalm is given in verse 1. May God arise. May his enemies be scattered. May his foes flee before him. And now look at verse 28 of the psalm. Summon your power, O God. Show us your strength, O God, as you have done before, because of your temple at Jerusalem. Kings will bring you gifts. Rebuke the beast among the reeds, the herd of bulls among the calves of the nations. Humbled may it bring bars of silver. Scatter the nations who delight in war. So you've got this beast lying among the reeds, this idea of this big weight, full of weight, full of fat perhaps, this mighty beast sitting there in the reeds. And the psalmist says to God, rebuke that beast. Let's look at one other, this time from Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 32 and verse 2. What I hope we're seeing is the same kind of language coming up that we've just read in that Job 40 and 41. The same kind of language, and there being no doubt at all from this language how it's being used. Ezekiel 32 and verse 2. Son of man, take up a lament concerning Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and say to him, you are like a lion among the nations, you are like a monster in the seas, thrashing about in your streams, churning the water with your feet, and muddying the streams. This is Pharaoh. He's like a lion, he's like a sea monster, thrashing about, muddying it all up, making it undrinkable. Come back a chapter, if you will, to chapter 29 and verse 3. This again is against Egypt. Speak to him and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, you great monster, lying among your streams. You say, the Nile is mine, I made it for myself, but I will put hooks in your jaws, and I will make the fish of your streams stick to your scales. I will pull you out from among your streams, with all the fish sticking to your scales. I'll leave you in the desert. You and all the fish of your streams, you'll fall upon the open field and not be picked up. I will give you as food to the beasts of the earth and the birds of the air. Again, we don't say what kind of animal is Pharaoh here. He's just some great monster lying there among the reeds. I'd like to do one more, this time back in Psalms, Psalm 74. Psalm 74. And verse 12. But you, O God, are my king from old. You bring salvation upon the earth. Notice the context. The context is salvation, and we've already seen that you can't have salvation without judgment. You bring salvation upon the earth. It was you who split open the sea by your power. What's he talking about? Well, perhaps Egypt in the Red Sea. It was you who split open the sea by your power, you who broke the heads of the monster in the waters. It was you who crushed the heads of Leviathan and gave him as food to the creatures in the desert. The heads of Leviathan. And so somebody's saying Leviathan is a crocodile. How many heads does the crocodile have? Well, I've only ever seen them with one. But I've seen lots of prophetic symbols of creatures with many heads. And this is exactly what's being talked about. It's a symbolic picture. Something with many heads. It was you who crushed the heads of Leviathan and gave him as food to the creatures of the desert. And we've already seen the theme of Rahab. Rahab, the monster that was in the sea, that was crushed by the power of God. And so there, Rahab was, if you like, a manifestation of the mighty beast. It was one form of the mighty beast, and then later on in history, the mighty beast takes another form, and later on in history, the mighty beast takes another form. The picture we get is that of this serpent in Eden, and I never know how big the serpent is. I guess I always imagine a little thing, but maybe it was a big creature, I don't know. You have the serpent there in Eden, relatively small, provoking the pride in mankind, provoking rebellion in man. And that pride becomes institutionalized. And the serpent becomes the symbol for that institutionalization of pride. And so the serpent, this Leviathan, gets bigger and bigger and bigger until by the time we look at Revelation, we find that it's an enormous dragon. And this enormous dragon in chapter 12 manifests itself in other beasts. It calls forth a beast out of the earth and a beast out of the sea. And these beasts look like the dragon itself. And ultimately, that mighty dragon, that mightiness of man's pride as he asserts himself against God, is destroyed in God's judgments. The beast and the false prophet are thrown into the lake of fire. The ancient serpent. Let's just glance, if you will, at Revelation 21. Its manifestations already being destroyed. In Revelation 21. No, I don't think it's 21. 20. Revelation 20, verse 2. He sees the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil or Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. He threw him into the abyss and locked and sealed it over him to keep him from deceiving the nations anymore until the 1,000 years were ended. And so we've got this dragon, this ancient serpent, and there we should think of it. God's saying there's a kind of continuity that goes all the way back to Genesis. The spirit of the serpent never died. It was there in people like you and me. And it was growing. And it was getting larger. As the world becomes more and more civilized, you get larger and larger powers. And pretty soon there will be a single mankind power on earth as globalization works its threads throughout all that we're doing. And he seizes the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil or Satan. Those are descriptions of him. The false accuser, the enemy, and bound him for 1,000 years. Verse 10 of chapter 20. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. They will be tormented day and night forever and ever. And it's talking about spiritual destruction of this enmity, this pridefulness that is in us all, that is going to be completely destroyed and thrown away. And this ancient serpent, this ancient spirit of rebellion that is part of all of us will be no more. It's interesting, actually, if you look at some of the commentators on the comment that they have on Rahab. As we've already established, Rahab is clearly a symbol of Egypt, and the destruction of Rahab was the destruction of Egypt in the Red Sea. Apparently, there are ancient Canaanite myths about a big sea monster called Rahab that was destroyed by the creating God. Of course, the Canaanites called that Baal. So you can see how the truth of the scripture got distorted into the religion of the people at that time. But it's a big monster that's there in the seas of the people. And we're talking metaphorically, of course. I mean, I hope I scarcely need say that we're not talking about a literal monster somewhere. It's a metaphorical picture. It's a spiritual picture. It's the pridefulness of man that is against God. And so when we come back to Job, God is starting to establish this picture in this very early writing. Take note that even though Job, the book of Job, contains things that are false, you suddenly stand back. Of course it does, because it contains the words of the three friends that are false. God says, "You three friends have spoken lies about me." So we need to take care when quoting from the book of Job. But here, we're quoting from the very words of Yahweh as he speaks from that whirling storm. And God himself is saying, look at these creatures, or look at this rebellion that is against me. And I think we should read verse 15 as the NIV has, this is Job 40, look at the behemoth which I made along with you. I think the sense is, look at the beast, this behemoth I made when I made you. That is, when God made us, he made a mighty beast. And that mighty beast establishes itself in opposition to him. The word behemoth is interesting, and again, I'm limping along with my rudimentary knowledge of Hebrew. The word itself is actually very common in the Old Testament. You might note that it's a plural word. You're probably familiar with the im ending as a plural. Well, the oth ending is also a plural. There's a singular word, behima, which just means a beast, like a cow. And if you have lots of beasts, lots of cows, you would say there's behemoth. It's the plural. It just means beasts. But what is interesting about this one is that we have the plural word, but it's not used as a plural word. It's used as a singular word. It's not, look at the beasts which I made along with you. The whole thing is singular. It's not what strength they have in their loins. It's what strength he has in his loins. One sort of plural beast, as it were. And so we have to say, why is it using a plural word as a singular? Well, we're familiar with other contexts. Another word, very familiar with another word, which is a plural word in form, but is used in singular context, the word Elohim. And the sense of Elohim, there is a sense of plurality in it, but there is much more a sense of majesty and mightiness. It's often described as a plurality of size rather than of number. And so the Elohim are the truly mighty ones, or the truly mighty one. God in some sense is Elohim by himself. And so we get behemoth. This plural now is plural of mightiness, not plural of number. And so we should translate verse 15 simply as, look at the mighty beast which I made along with you. It's a mighty beast. One, but just ginormous in size. The word Leviathan in chapter 41, the idea behind Leviathan is something that's wreathed, something that's coiling, this coiling serpent. And you recall that that's exactly the picture that was being pulled out of Isaiah 27 and verse 1. Leviathan, the coiling serpent. And so we've got this mighty beast described in chapter 15, and then in verse 15, and then in chapter 41, talking about Leviathan, can you pull him out? And actually, I've ended up concluding that there is only one beast being talked about here. That Leviathan is the mighty beast. It's not that there are two beasts, and we'll come and see some evidence for that later on. So what God is saying is, Job, Are you going to discredit my justice in order to justify yourself? Are you going to assert yourself over me? Are you going to consider your righteousness more important in your own eyes than my justice? Can you, Job, take the proud and bury them in the dust and save yourself? Is this what you're trying to tell me, Job? Man, what a mighty beast I made when I made you. And he's not just talking to Job, he's talking to us all. And we know it. We know that sense of pridefulness that grows in us. That sense of rebellion against God. That the way we look at things is right and therefore God must be wrong. And we saw how Paul objected against that and said, no, you mustn't think that. We saw how David said, no, I will fall before you and I will acknowledge my sin to emphasize that you are right, O God. And I'm wrong. So now let's look at some of the detail of this mighty beast, this Leviathan, and see that even in the fine detail of the poetry, this same symbolism comes out. When I first was exploring this and discussing it with somebody, they said, well, I'm not really happy about the idea of just viewing it symbolically, because look, it's very literal. It feeds on grass like the ox. That's so literal. Why are you trying to make it all symbolic? Why are you trying to make it all metaphorical? A good question. Numbers 22, verse 4. Interestingly, the start of the Balaam record. The Moabites, verse 4 of Numbers 22, said to the elders of Midian, this horde, talking about the people of Israel, the children of Israel as they come up out of Egypt through the land of the Sinai, this horde is going to lick up everything around us as an ox licks up the grass of the field. So immediately we see that this idea of licking up the grass or eating up the grass, and you know how an ox does it, sort of curls its tongue around and yanks the grass out by the roots. This licking up of the grass is used symbolically at this very same time in history. It can be used symbolically. But I think even more powerfully that it's not just a random choice, oh, it feeds on grass like an ox. What is grass? What is grass symbolically in Scripture? Well, Isaiah 40, let me just read it to you, or you can turn if you like, but Isaiah 40, verse 6, a voice says, cry out. And I said, what shall I cry? All men are like grass, and their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers, and the flowers fall because the breath of the Lord blows on them. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, and the flowers fall, but the word of our God stands forever. What does Behemoth eat? He eats men. He eats the grass. All men are grass. That is what Behemoth feeds upon. And you only have to turn on your televisions or look at your newspapers or go down the street to realize that this mighty, prideful beast is feeding upon men and women. That they're becoming part of the beast. That they're joining with the power of the beast. Nebuchadnezzar had to learn this lesson of who he was and how he was in some sense truly living his life. Do you remember what happened to him when the vision came to him that he was going to be brought low and Daniel gave him the prediction as to what was happening? Let me just read it from Daniel 4 and verse 25. 24 for context. This is the interpretation, O king. This is the decree the Most High has issued against my lord the king. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like cattle and be drenched with the dew of heaven. And so here is Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, which at the time that Daniel was writing and Daniel was living, Babylon was the embodiment of the beast. And the leader of that empire had to learn that. You have to learn that you are a beast and that you are under the control of the Lord Almighty. And so he will show you that you are no different from a real beast. You'll go out into the fields and you'll eat the grass. And you'll appreciate, finally you'll appreciate that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of heaven. Back to Job then. Job chapter 40 and verse 17. The NIV has, his tail sways like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are close-knit. Again, I suspect we don't need to establish it anymore, but suppose we're going with the common expectation of the commentators that this is the hippopotamus. This is not exactly a description of a hippopotamus as I've seen them. His tail sways like a cedar. In the hippopotamus, it hangs like a pathetic piece of string on the back. But look at Revelation 12, the one that we've been talking about, this mighty dragon that is appearing up in the sky. Verse 3 of Revelation 12, another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, 7 crowns upon his heads of Leviathan, if you like. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky, flung them to the earth. This is what we're talking about. We're talking about this dragon, this rebellion. Or verse 18 of Job 40, talking about this mighty beast. His bones are tubes of bronze, his limbs like rods of iron. And again, iron and bronze, we start to think perhaps of Nebuchadnezzar's image and seeing that image as it stands in opposition to God. But also, let me quote Micah 4, verse 13. This is the promise that is being given in the last days when the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established. Verse 13, rise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will give you horns of iron, I will give you hoofs of bronze. You will break to pieces many nations. It's the sense of a national power that is strong, that is able to achieve things in the world. Israel is to go out and gore nations. But here it is Behemoth that has the bones of bronze and limbs like rods of iron. Now, I said earlier that I think that Leviathan and Behemoth are actually the same beast. Leviathan is the mighty beast that is being described here. And if you look at verse 19, in describing the mighty beast, you have, he ranks first among the works of God. That is, he's almost the largest thing, the most majestic thing among the works of God. But if you look at chapter 41 and verse 33, it says, nothing on earth is his equal. That is, nothing equals Leviathan. So the mighty beast in chapter 40 ranks first, and Leviathan, nothing is his equal. Seems to me those are two ways of saying exactly the same thing. So Leviathan is this mighty beast. He's so powerful, and nothing on earth is his equal. How are you going to bring down the mighty beast that we see in the world today? Whether it's the Roman power or whether it's the American power. How are you going to bring it down? What power are you going to use? And you can't. But our Maker can. In that day, we already read it, the Lord will punish with his sword, his fierce, great, and powerful sword, Leviathan, the gliding serpent, Leviathan, the coiling serpent. He will slay the monster of the sea. Look at verse 20. The hills bring him their produce, and all the wild animals play nearby. Well, it's a rotten translation, and I'm afraid the King James is no better. Ronald Knox has got a great translation of this verse in the Knox translation. He says, and I quote, whole mountainsides, the playground of his fellow beasts, will he lay under tribute. Think of that. Whole mountainsides, that's where the fellow beasts play, the other smaller nations play. He lays them under tribute. That's exactly the process of globalization that we're seeing, the process of empire that we have been seeing throughout all of history. That the manifestation of the pride of man gradually reaches out and collects other nations and brings it into the same group. We've already looked at verse 21, essentially, when we were quoting Psalm 68 and Ezekiel 29 about hiding among the reeds in the marsh. In those contexts, it was Egypt as the beast that was hiding in the reeds. But the picture here is not simply of Egypt, it's of any expression of the pride of mankind. Verse 23, when the river rages, he's not alarmed, he's secure, though the Jordan should surge against his mouth. This picture of the flood waters coming down. And as soon as we use that kind of word, we realize, oh yes, flood, that's all about nations attacking other nations. That's all about battle. Let me just read Isaiah chapter 8, verse 6. Because this people has rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah and rejoices over Rezin and the sons of Remaliah, therefore the Lord is about to bring against them the mighty flood waters of the river. The king of Assyria with all his pomp, it will overflow all its channels and sweep over all its banks and sweep on into Judah, swirling over it, passing through it, and reaching up to its neck. Its outspread wings will cover the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. So this idea of the flood coming against Behemoth. Again, it's not just literal water that's being talked about. It's armies being thrown against him. And the pridefulness of man is such that whatever comes against him, it stands. It's able to be there. Chapter 24, verse 24 of Job 40. I like the way the NIV translates it. Can anyone capture him by the eyes or trap him and pierce his nose? And I think it flows on immediately into chapter 41, where it's not just talking about anyone. It now focuses on you, Job. Job, can you pull in the Leviathan with a fish hook or tie down his tongue with a rope? Can you put a cord through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? And again, what's it talking about? I think the picture here is of the kind of hooks that they used to put into the vanquished kings. As they would take a king it's horrible. They put the hooks in their eyes and pull them behind them in procession. And it's symbolic of what they were doing to the nation. You put a hook into the nation and you pull it along. And it's not painful. I mean, it's not comfortable, but painful. Chapter 41. Any hope of subduing him, this is Leviathan, is false. The mere sight of him is overpowering. No one is fierce enough to rouse him. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has a claim against me that I must pay? Everything under heaven belongs to me. Again, I think Knox in the Latin translation is particularly helpful. Actually, this is a place where the Latin Vulgate departs somewhat from the Masoretic text, and it's not entirely clear which one is the most original, as it were. Has some error crept into the Masoretic text, or has some error in this place, a different error, crept into the Latin? But let me give you the translation of the Latin for verses 9 to 11. And see how powerful it is. Talking about Leviathan, it is in mercy that I forbear to make him a plague for mankind. But indeed, there is no resisting me, nor can any deserve my thanks for lending me the aid I lacked. Everything on earth is at my disposal. I give him no quarter for all his boastful, all his flattering words. So you have this mighty beast of the nations asserting itself against God. And God says, it's in mercy that I allow him to be there. But, in fact, he's under my power at all times. I don't need to ask anybody for help. Everything on earth is at my disposal. And even though he boasts, even though he flatters himself, I give him no quarter. Verse 18 of chapter 41. His snorting throws out flashes of light. His eyes are like the rays of the dawn. And again, it echoes something that's there in Revelation. Let me just read it to you. Revelation chapter 13 and verse 13. It's one of the beasts that is there as a manifestation of the dragon that's there in heaven. And this manifestation of the beast, in this case, the beast of the earth, we read, he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven in full view of men. And I wonder whether that's the idea God has here in Job 41 and verse 18. His snorting throws out flashes of light. His eyes are like the rays of dawn. Firebrands stream from his mouth. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke pours from his nostrils. As from a boiling pot over a fire of reeds, his breath sets coals ablaze and flames dart from his mouth. Again, it's not a literal creature that's being talked about. It's a prophetic, it's a symbolic kind of picture that we're being given. Just one more on this, the last verse, verse 34. He looks down on all that are haughty. He is king over all that are proud. And again, Ronald Knox, when translating this, has a beautiful phrase that he has. He talks about Leviathan's heaven-confronting eye. He has this heaven-confronting eye. He looks up to God, as it were, and he juts out the chin, and he says, "Who do you think you are, God? I am the powerful one. I am the mighty beast. I can do what I like." And this beast is king over all that are proud. And so what God now is saying in the sweep of this speech, see the majesty of it now, he says, look, it's not all about the natural creation and my majesty and power over the natural creation, but there's the spiritual creation that's important as well. Men and women, whether they acknowledge my justice or not, whether they can have the ability to bring judgment or not, Job recognized what a mighty beast there is in the earth, in the hearts of men and women, that asserts itself against me and that is king of all the proud. Job, how easily, how closely you've come to the edge of rebellion. You've almost become part of this beast, Job, in standing and confronting me with the words that you've said. You've almost made Leviathan. I know you can do all things. You asked, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. It's all about justice versus pride and rebellion. And which side are we on? Are we making Leviathan our king? Or are we making God our king? There's another aspect about this. Remember that translation of verse 9 through 11 of chapter 41. It's, in mercy I forbear to make him a plague for mankind. Why doesn't God intervene now and stamp out wickedness? Why doesn't God come down on earth and just destroy all wickedness? And the answer is because all would be destroyed. There would be no flesh left. None would survive, because we also have wickedness within us until we're perfected. We have this struggle between the things of the spirit and the things of the flesh. Which way are we going to go? And the Lord works with us throughout our lives, guiding us, bringing us to focus on the things of the spirit and to reject the things of the flesh and to reject the rebellion that we see around us all the time. I'd like to finish by going to Psalm 73. We've already looked at this psalm in some detail earlier on in the week. But there's one beautiful glimpse here. I took this word behemoth and looked it up in the concordance. And as I say, my Hebrew is rudimentary. And the word itself, behemoth, occurs quite frequently. But it occurs normally in a plural context, meaning the beasts, the cattle that are in the field, lots of them. Job 41, it occurs very definitely there in a singular context. So I was trying to find another place that this plural word, behemoth, occurs in a singular context. And it turns out that it occurs in Psalm 73, this psalm that, for different reasons, we've already gone to almost as a summary of the book of Job. And so we find the situation where the psalmist is struggling with the fact that the wicked don't seem to have any problems, and looks at almost is on the verge of betraying God. And he says, verse 18, surely you place them on slippery ground, you cast them down to ruin. How suddenly are they destroyed, completely swept away by terrors. He appreciates this truth when he's there in the sanctuary of God. In verse 21, he says, when my heart was grieved and my spirit embittered, I was senseless and ignorant. I was behemoth before you. And it's true of us. When our hearts are grieved before God, our spirits embittered towards him, if we're not careful, we can become senseless and ignorant, and we can partake in behemoth. We can also come to the point of rebellion. We also, like Job, need to be confronted not only by the awesome majesty of God in the natural world, but the awesome majesty of his work in the spiritual world, of taking people like you and me and being able to find and to being able to plant a spark of righteousness, to allow something to grow in us that's Christ-like. And as a consequence, we can be rescued from participating in behemoth. We also will be lifted up and restored in our humility. He says in verse 23, yet I am always with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterwards, you will take me into glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? Earth has nothing I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever.